Morning!
Shut up, honestly.
Have you just got up?
No, I haven't just got up, but it's... Oh, what time is this? What even is this?
It is 8:30. I have literally been up for 2 hours.
I know. This. I bet you have. You've been dancing on the beach.
I have.
Naked and...
Yeah, of course.
Sacrificing a goat to a pebble god or whatever it is you do.
Yeah, exactly. Just an average quiet time, you know.
What is wrong with you? I became a writer so that I didn't have to get up at this time on a Saturday morning. That was entirely the purpose.
Well, I don't know whether we're actually recording this now, but tell the listeners why we're doing this now on a Saturday instead of at the normal time. What are you doing, Judas, without me?
I'm going to America to speak.
Yes.
Well, anyway, let's get this thing going.
I want to do the welcome because you're so grumpy and tired.
All right, go on then.
Thank you. I think I shall. Hello, my name's Nick Page, and I'm here as ever with my dear friend Joe Davis. Hello, Joe. How are you doing? I'm fine, thank you. It's the morning. How are you, Nick? I am grumpy and miserable because I'm going to America. Thank you.
No, I'm not. Why are you so bitter about going to America? Lots of people have been to America, and it's not that great, is it?
It is great. It is wonderful. And you're going to be seeing people that I know and love.
I know,
also,
that's lovely.
And that's lovely. Irritating. And, yes.
It's you know, but I mean, they're just the same as us, really. Everybody puts their trousers on one leg at a time, same as we do, really. Actually, maybe the president doesn't. I don't know, actually. Probably has somebody to do that for him. Anyway.
Probably does.
Good morning. Well, yes, yeah, so we're recording this early because I've got a speaking trip and, 8:30 on a Saturday morning.
Yeah.
That's dedication.
The crack of dawn, Nick.
That's dedication.
So, other than tired, how are you?
I'm all right, actually. Yeah, I'm okay. Yeah. I've got my cup of tea, so I'm all right, really.
Yeah.
And you all right?
Yeah. I got my coffee and all is well, as they say.
Good. Have you really been up for 2 hours?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Oh, you're just...
No, I really...
Something clinically wrong with you, isn't there?
I like mornings. I'm not a night person.
You're very loud as well in the mornings, aren't you?
I don't know what you mean. Anyway, shall we get on with the show?
Yeah, shall we? Because I want to go back to bed.
Shall I do emails?
Yeah,
now?
Let's do emails. That's,
okay, we had a great one from a lovely lady in South Africa, Lee. Hello, Lee. She was commenting on Jill's podcast with us, which I think we have said, and I hope the bitterness has come through, was one of the better podcasts. she was talking about she liked the way Jill redefined helper and what that was. And she says, I also wanted to chip in a thought about referring to God as female. Jill's advice about asking why applies here. Why, if God is sexless and we can intellectually acknowledge that, do we cling so tightly to referring to him as a male? Is it really only because Jesus referred to him as father, or is there a deeper bias behind this reluctance? Just the fact that people get so defensive about God being male tells me there's more to it than supposed scriptural authenticity. And I think there's more to look for here than a happy middle ground. Understanding why it's important for people to be able to call God female without some congregants' heads imploding would be a positive first step. Mm-hmm, yeah. Anyway, thanks for the interview with Jill, or shall I call her Dave Rowe?
I think we've moved beyond Dave. I think we should call the other Daves Jill.
I think that's a step in the right direction now, yeah.
Yes, everybody should be called Jill. Well, that's very good. I agree with that.
Mm. Yep. Thank you. And
Thank you,
South Africa. I wonder if that's our only South African listener. I assume it probably would be. But anyway, that's great. Had one from Meg. Said, I've been listening to your podcast since the article in Christianity magazine. I'm pretty sure I've been having a mid-faith crisis for a while now. I've been sticking my head in the sand in the manner of an ostrich, trying to ignore it and hoping it goes away. It's not going away. And having somewhere to turn, knowing I'm not alone in the heathen doubts and questions is very helpful. So thank you. He says, I particularly enjoyed your conversation about men's and women's ministry. We attend a great church and the various ministries do really excellent work. But the men's stuff is always focused around food or outdoorsy stuff. Men's breakfast, men's curry night, fishing, that sort of thing. The ladies have a great Bible study group and regular meetings to discuss different topics and to eat cake. My husband and I sometimes talk about this. He wants cake and in-depth Bible study, like the ladies' group, and I want curry and bacon. Yeah. Not so bothered about the fishing, though. I mean this in a light-hearted way because my church is excellent, but it does go to show that stereotyping can be alienating. Yeah. And blah, 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 blah. Anyway, it's all good stuff, and it's just making that point. Really.
Yeah, we talked about that a bit last time. I think that's yeah, very true. Although curry and bacon, possibly not a best combination, Meg, if I can say so.
Oh, not a bad breakfast, though.
Well, not for you. You'd eat anything.
Curry and breakfast. Don't knock it.
I never have breakfast. I have a black coffee, and then I snarl for a bit.
So, my first child, who is of the female gender, I believe, she would say, and I know she'd want me to say, her favourite breakfast is leftover curry.
Is it?
Oh, yeah, leftover Indian. It's like her dream breakfast. She's a curious soul. She doesn't really like sweets, desserts, puddings.
Right, yeah,
so she doesn't really do breakfast. She never really knows what she wants lunch, but she would happily eat three dinners a day, three square dinners a day.
Do you know, I was drinking last night tomato juice. Do you like tomato juice?
It depends whether it's got any vodka and Worcester sauce in it.
My daughter said, I like tomato juice with Worcester sauce. My daughter said to me, she said, savoury drinks, they're always wrong.
Really?
I suppose so. I never really thought about it. Anyway, carry on.
No. What about a hot Bovril?
Oh dear lord!
Isn't a soup a savoury drink in a way? I mean, it is when you have it from a mug.
That's true, actually. Yeah, she's wrong.
Huh. Just go back to
so
your
what,
daughter.
Mad? Huh.
Which one was that? One, two, or three?
Two.
Well, she's mad. I think we agreed on that.
Go on then.
Okay, one from Gareth, who says this. He said, "I wanted to raise a subject with you that's been bothering me for a while, and is one that I feel unable to talk about honestly with my church. That is the subject of heaven." Heaven is something that, if I think about it too much, scares the crap out of me. Not fear of not going, but fear of what I will be leaving behind. I've heard a lot of different ideas about heaven. Things like new bodies, no marriage, singing never-ending praise to God. But here's the thing. A lot of these ideas sound rubbish. I happen to really like... He's got a very good point. It gets better. Yeah. I happen to really like my wife. And while at times I enjoy worshipping God, continuous 24/7 praise sounds draining. I know this might seem slightly ridiculous, but death and what I will face bothers me. The problem I have, though, is I know so many Christians who say they are not worried about death and say it as if I shouldn't be bothered either, which leads me to not want to talk about my concerns. Is it just me that feels like this? Am I supposed to faithfully accept whatever it is will be good and I should trust God? And if so, how do I get rid of this feeling of dread whenever I think of the afterlife? There's a lot there, I know, but you were the only people I could think of I could honestly email without being worried about a backlash from people doubting my faith.
Well, may I start by doubting your faith, Gareth?
Yes.
That's undermined your argument. I love that, and I think Gareth, we'll come back to this topic, I think, in more detail at some point, because I think it's a great topic to think about. And I think that I empathise with a lot of that. I think George Orwell described the description of, for example, of heaven in Revelation as like choir practice in a jeweller's shop, because everybody's standing around on crystal and singing songs the whole time. And I've never found that at all appealing.
No.
I don't know, what do you think? Are you worried about death?
No, I'm genuinely not worried about death, actually. Because I think in part because when I work with it the entire time, I think you can't help but think about it perhaps more than others do. But I mean, I guess my views would be different to yours slightly and a bit more, you know, cosmic and out there and blah, blah, blah.
Of course they would.
Yeah.
Well, I think we should come back to it. Can I recommend that one of the things that completely changed my excitement levels about the afterlife was Tom Wright's books. He wrote a book called Surprised by Hope, which is about the idea that actually our idea of going to heaven is completely wrong. And we're not going to heaven. We're going to be on the new earth, a new creation. Mm. And that's a very good book, but there's a shorter version of it, even better. A Grove booklet called New Heavens, New Earth, I think. And it's about sort of 60 pages like this. But that
sounds more like my book.
Yeah, exactly. That completely changed how excited I could get about... what happens next. Yeah. But I think we should come back to this topic.
Yeah, let's do that.
But do it, you know, and talk about it in a bit more detail. Thank you, Gareth, for that. I mean, what it did when I was thinking about it, those books, I thought, well, it'd be good for us to talk about some of the books that have really affected us and changed us. I thought it'd be good to institute our top five books, and then we can keep revisiting this year on year and see what changes. People love a good top five list, don't they?
Yeah, they do. They're very popular on the Facebook.
Yeah, on the Facebook.
Yes.
So we're gonna look at some books this episode that we recommend. Joe's will largely be colouring, I imagine. I'm not sure.
I do, although some of those have got quite difficult now, I notice, to be fair.
Hard for you to keep within the line.
I know. Whatever happened to the simple join the dots?
I thought I'd start by asking one of our regular contributors to talk about what books she would recommend.
Yeah.
So this is Ethel, and she's written in. She's written back.
Great.
Dear Reverend and Mrs. Davis, she said, there's nothing I like better than curling up with a good book, even though it's a practice which has got me thrown out of several libraries and bookshops. Anyway, my favourite reading is, of course, the spiritually devout writings of Puritans. Everyone should read Calvin's Institutes, but his follow-up, Calvin's Women's Institutes, contains more jam recipes. For children, I recommend Fox's Book of Martyrs, the illustrated pop-up version. Some of the flames are very realistic. And then she goes on. Oh, and then there is the trilogy of lovely children's classics, Noddy in Toyland, Noddy in Candyland, and Noddy in Eternal Conscious Damnation.
Lovely.
I think we've all benefited. For those among you who wish to exercise proper male headship, of recent conversations, yeah, I suggest reading The Purpose-Driven Wife. Yeah, that is very good. Gives her a sense of meaning. She says, finally, may
skating
I humbly...
Skating on thin ice now.
I know. She doesn't listen. I'm okay. Finally, may I humbly recommend my autobiography, 50 Shades of Ethel. It's an inspiring story of one woman's struggle against the forces of evil, powers and principalities, and local town planning restrictions. But what are your favourite books, she asks. I'm not interested to read them, but I'd like to know which books we should publicly burn next year. Yours, Ethel Saddle Person, bracket Mrs. So that's... lovely. I think
nice.
If my publishers are listening, we should do some of those.
We actually should.
Calvin's Women's Institute sounds brilliant. Anyway... Can you imagine what they'd be like? It'd be great. This week we've been predestined to make marmalade.
Okay.
Right.
We're going to do five each. Is that that's the plan?
Yes, that's the thing. I'm going to skate through them quickly.
And in a nod to recent conversations, I have very generously handed one and one only of my five choices over to Rachel. So.
Oh, man, you should read The Purpose-Driven Wife.
Exactly. So through the.
So is she coming in to present him?
I would imagine so. Yeah.
Oh, that'd be great.
I'll probably have to leave the room, and she'll probably be irritatingly good and better than me, and then we get all the abuse that comes from that. But we'll take
very
it.
Very good. Okay.
We'll take
right.
it.
Good.
It is.
So do you want to kick off?
I don't mind. I mean, this is hard. So this is not in any way my top five. This is just five. Anyway, so here we go. First one. And forgive me if these are rather obvious, but it has to be my favourite devotional book, which is Return of the Prodigal by Henri Nouwen.
Nouwen. It's pronounced Henri Nouwen. Everybody gets it wrong.
Are you going to
French?
Oh, sorry. So you're going to interrupt me all the time, are you now? That's how this is going to work.
No, I'll be good.
Right.
Thank you. It is a great book. Carry
it
on.
Is a great book, and if you were French, you would be very comfortable saying Henri. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, Henri, as he was known by his mates, has written many great books, but this one was his reflections on the painting, The Return of the Prodigal. And it's just this superb journey. I mean, I'm not a particularly keen art lover the way you are, but Henri Nouwen, he sat in front of this painting by Rembrandt for days, just reflecting on it. Now I can't even begin to get my head around you know, why someone would do that. But the insights and revelation that came from that were just superb. So what he does is he takes you on a journey through the three central characters of the painting and making comments on all of them, but also describing a spiritual journey. So you've obviously got the father, and you've got the two sons, the prodigal and the older brother. And the journey he takes you on is this, that he says, you know, we all start our spiritual journey as the prodigal, and everyone wants to feel like they're the prodigal, you know, coming home and the party, and, you know, there's a party in heaven, and, you know, that's all good. But he says, inevitably, we all become the older brother, which is quite interesting. And there's some quite uncomfortable reading as you read that, and you think, oh my goodness, there's a lot of truth here. And then, but he says, but the journey is towards becoming like the father in the story.
It's a great book.
Love it's just book. Beautiful. And I just think, if you're a bit burnt out and washed up, and, you know, kind of, I don't want to do faith or church or anything like that, this book is a book you can read, and it will just gently warm your heart, I think.
Hmm. I think it is interesting. Later in life, he became very interested in art. He also wrote a fantastic book on icons. Behold the Beauty of the Lord. It's very good. So, you know, I think... Yeah, I love that book. Very good. And it's about the journey. I'm going to go for something equally deep as my first pick, and that is Mummin Papa at Sea by Tove Jansson.
I don't know.
No, have you never read the Mummin stories?
I don't think so, no.
Like that. They're great. So these are children's books, series of children's books of the Mummins. You'll know the Mummins because they're everywhere. So they're little troll-like creatures. And Tove Jansson was a Finnish artist, and she invented them and drew them as well. And but what's interesting is as the series goes on, they become less and less for children. Mm. These books are, so the final stories in the series, Mumminland in November and Mummin Papa at Sea, are not really about children at all. They're about loss and about you know, loneliness and isolation, but very, very Nordic. Mm. But Mummin Papa at Sea is, I've always said, the best book on midlife and mid-faith crisis, midlife crisis particularly, for because it's about the character of Mummin Papa and his sense of losing his purpose completely. And they have to go off and live on an island in order for him to rediscover that. And along the way, there's lots of reflections on friendship and on family and what it means. And there's just this lovely bit in there where she writes this. She says, it's strange, Mummin Mama, that's his wife, thought, strange that people can be sad and even angry because life is too easy. But that's the way it is, I suppose. The only thing is to do is to start life afresh. And, you know, there's a lovely feel to it. And I just wanted to throw that in because I'd already used up the Velveteen Rabbit in an earlier podcast, which I would normally recommend. Lewis said, the test of a good children's book, or a children's book rather, that can only be read by children is not a good children's book. And so I've never differentiated in that sense. And I think this is a wonderful book for those who like that kind of thing. Yeah. That's my first pick. There you go.
I think that's probably true of children's films as well. Anyway.
Indeed, absolutely. Good. Absolutely, yeah.
Great.
So, next one.
Next one. You know, hard push to pick any Richard Rohr. So I just decided to pick the first one I ever read, which was called Everything Belongs. Mm. And it's called The Gift of Contemplative Prayer. And... and I guess I chose this because I'd never come across Richard Rohr. And when I read this book, I realised that there was such a huge part of my prayer life that had just been missing, that I'd never really encountered or engaged with. And this rescued prayer for me completely, reading this. And I'll just quote one line. I mean, it's one of those books, I guess most of these books would inevitably be ones with tons of underlining in. But the bit that really struck me as I was just flicking through it was this line that says, "The most important way is to live and fully accept our reality." And I guess in a nutshell is about what this book is all about. It's about how do you truly live in a way that is present to everything that is going on in your life? The happiness, the sadness, the depression, all of those things. How do you live in such a way where you can accept everything that's going on? And he says that is that's contemplative prayer.
I've not read that one. I knew you'd have a Richard Rohr in there.
Yeah.
To my publisher, Andy, who listens to this yesterday, I said, I'll have Richard Rohr in there somewhere.
Yeah, I know.
I knew it. Yeah.
Boringly but predictable.
I wouldn't have got that one. But, I mean, I think that's true. And interestingly, the quote you picked up is something that I want to pick up in some of my choices. So that's great.
Yeah.
Everything Belongs by Richard Rohr, then. My second one is a bit more obscure. If you can be more obscure than a children's book to start with. It's called The Courage to Doubt by Robert Davidson. And I only read this recently. And the reason I picked this is because it's an analysis of the Old Testament and looking at the role that doubt and questioning plays in the Old Testament.
Okay.
And the massive presence that it has in developing the faith of Israel. And that actually we look at the Old Testament as though it's a sort of a very certain book, you know, very kind of conservative book full of, you know, all the laws and everything. And it's absolutely convinced it's right kind of thing. And actually, there's tons of instances in the Old Testament where people question God, where they argue, where they realise they've got it wrong and change things. And what's great about this book, it was written by this guy who I think was a professor of Old Testament at the University of Glasgow, and it comes from 1983, so it's quite a while back. It's really kind of rigorous. He knows his stuff, and he just goes through it, looking at how God can be known and yet hidden, how the writers of the Old Testament reflect on this. It's completely changed my view on it. So I'll give you a little quote here. He says, this is at the end of one of the chapters, which is on the prophets. He's looking at Habakkuk, which is the only Old Testament book that's named after the noise a chicken makes, I think. Anyway, and Habakkuk says this. He says, the barns are empty, the crops have failed, the fold is bare. Happy am I still have the Lord as my God. And that is the true and indestructible reason for rejoicing. He says this, the vindication of faith lies in faith itself, but that certainty only comes to those who have questioned and discarded the meretricious trappings in which faith is often decked. And that's what the book's all about. Yeah. It's about the destruction of old ideas and the beginning of new ideas and the role that doubt plays. So Courage to Doubt by Robert Davidson. Really great. Recommend that.
Okay, my next. My next choice is, I was trying to do something that wasn't just me, but one we'd done at Soul Place that I just thought was a fantastic book for groups. Now, again, that's difficult to pick one. I feel like I'm going to get really seriously attacked by all my Renovari chums for not picking Richard Foster or Dallas Willard or anything. But Brian McLaren produced a book a couple of years back called We Make the Road by Walking. And he designed this book specifically for small cultish groups like my own, Soul Place. And it's basically he is retelling the whole story of the Bible. And there's quite a lot of scripture to read as you go through it. But it's designed so a group can read a chapter in an evening and then discuss the chapter coming out of it and read all the scripture alongside it. So he basically has done this in sort of 52 parts. So it should last a year. But of course, you know, we took longer over it. I think we took about 18 months to go through it. And he retells the story of the entire biblical narrative in four parts. So the first part is alive in the story of creation. The next is alive in the adventure of Jesus. The next is alive in a global uprising. And the fourth one is alive in the Spirit of God. And so what he does in 52 parts is brilliantly goes through the whole narrative of the Bible, but he encourages you to look at it all with fresh eyes. And because you're reading bits of scripture, but you're telling them in the context of the overarching story of the Bible, all kinds of new insights emerge. And our group found it really, really helpful. I think because for some of them, there's a lot of new books coming out that don't contain much scripture, and that makes them nervous, particularly if you've grown up in the evangelical tradition. We kind of want scripture. We don't just want fanciful ideas that don't seem earthly. And Brian McLaren, bless him, has provided that. So just a really helpful book for groups. We got a tremendous amount through doing that, and very helpful questions. In fact, same question every week. Actually, what jumped out at you? What encouraged you? What warned you? It's really, really good. So that's Walking by Brian McLaren.
I haven't read that book, but I think again, I with your group, in a sense that, you know, it's not that I feel the books need scripture to validate their truth, particularly because truth is truth. But I think that I love books that make me look at the Bible afresh.
Yeah.
Which is what I was just talking about, the Davidson book and what that book does. You know, I love books that suddenly you realise, hang on, it doesn't say that. Or hang on, it says something different. Or it's speaking in a different way, because I think that's where the Word of God really comes alive.
Exactly. And I think especially if you're at the place in your life where you've basically stopped reading the Bible, or you've got fed up with it, or you've decided you don't understand it or don't like it. What this book does is it gives you a whole new love for the Bible again.
Great. Yeah. Oh, well, I'll get hold of that one.
Yeah.
So my choice, my next choice is actually, you talked about the Richard Rohr book, which sounds really interesting about prayer. This is a book that completely changed my view of prayer and how I pray. And it's called Into the Silent Land.
I love this book.
The Practice of Contemplation by Martin Laird. It's a dense, you know, it's difficult at times, but it's a brilliant introduction to contemplative prayer.
Yeah.
And it led me into some real experiences that even now I don't really talk about, you know, that in terms of prayer. And it's just talking about the presence of God. The prayer isn't transactional. It's not this thing that we do. Mm. It's not this job that we have to do, this duty that we have to do. He talks about it as, you know, becoming in touch with the ground of our being. He says this is a great line. He says, because God is the ground of our being, the relationship between creature and creator is such that by sheer grace, separation is not possible. God does not know how to be absent. So, you know, that's contemplative great. Prayer for him is not like this this duty that you do. It's like falling back into the long grass. It's like swimming in the sea. It's like becoming aware of God being all around you. So for me, it completely changed things. I haven't read the follow-up, though, actually. There's another one.
Sunlit Absence.
Yeah, I haven't read that. Is that just about being quiet? I can't remember.
I found it harder than this book. I genuinely think this stands alongside the Richard Rohr book as slightly different.
Okay, good.
Because
so those two would be good to read.
Yeah,
together,
the Richard Rohr book kind of sets up contemplative prayer, but that book is actually far more practical in terms of how do we do it and what about all the distraction and what happens when my mind is just all over the place. And he's very encouraging about that, I think.
I mean, it's interesting, actually. I've just been reading a book on mindfulness by Ruby Wax. It's very funny.
I went to see her speak about it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
And just struck so much by how in these, the great authors and in the spiritual practices of the church, we sort of anticipate so much of this. Yeah, the church could have just got his act together and stuck with a lot of these classic disciplines. Yeah. We really would be in a better headspace. Anyway, Into the Silent Land, Martin Laird. That's a great book. So,
my fourth choice. And I don't have a fourth choice, so I'm giving it to Rachel. So shall I go get Rachel?
Yeah,
okay.
Do that.
Right, okay. Rach, do you want to come do it? Nick is here. Try not to be better than me.
Hello.
Hello.
How lovely to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
Well, what a privilege to be here. I'm actually allowed in and not creeping around the house being extra quiet.
Is that what you have to do all the time? Is that what he makes you do?
I'm not every usually day. Here on a... Well, obviously.
He's so domineering. Anyway, tell us about this book then, Rachel, that you've chosen.
Okay, it's called The Dance of the Dissident Daughter, and it's by a lady called Sue Monk Kidd. Jo just suggested that I read a bit from my journal. I read it back in 2014 when I was on a spiritual direction course. And it was recommended as part of the looking at feminine and male spirituality. And I was reading it and I was sort of writing a reflection in my journal. So if you don't mind, Jo suggested that it would be a good idea if I read this.
Yeah, no, let's have some proper content. It'd be wonderful.
Okay, so I was thinking about women, wise women, who've been comfortable being women, strong, wise and God-centred. And I sort of began to realise the lack of them in my life. And then I wondered, is that because I've never gone looking for them? Or is it more to do with how women are expected to be in Christian circles? And very few actually become that sort of role model, revelling in being divine, relating to the feminine divine. So I started reading this book and it's an eye-opener once you start seeing the masculine control and imagery and thinking that overwhelms culture and the church. And I began to see why there aren't the role models available. Oh, there are plenty of good Christian women who are held up as good Christian women by male teaching. But when I've ever heard a sermon or a talk on the sacred feminine, when's God ever been talked about as anything other than male? It creates a feeling of women as slightly less than best. How can our femininity be celebrated and found in the divine? And I find I understand why some women may turn to perhaps New Age thinking, which celebrates Mother Earth in her creativity and sustaining of life. Where are the feminine images that capture me, that relate to who I am deep down inside, a woman created in the image of God? Not an afterthought created for men to lord over, not weak-willed or easily manipulated, but strong women who are comfortable with their femininity, delighting in and connecting with feminine aspects of God, which there must be plenty of, as we were created in the image of God. And then a few days later, I wrote, this book's really screwing with my mind. Not really sure what to think. Can I trust it? Can I trust that stuff that's sort of resonating with what's inside? So it was a bit of a, it did clearly screw with me, but it really challenged my thinking about who God was and how I related to God and where I could find
God. And has that become clearer since? I mean, in terms
Absolutely,
that was the initial response a few days after, but
yeah,
since it's, you've come to terms with that a lot more, it seems.
Yeah, oh, definitely. It's really become a big part of my spirituality and who I am. Yeah.
Thank you. That's brilliant. That's great. Lots to think about there. And well, would you please stay on the show and we'll get rid of the other guy because he's a bit pants. He's a bit rubbish. He's a bit too loud early in the morning, Rachel. How do you cope with it?
Many years of practice.
Yeah, indeed. What a saintly woman you are. What a saintly woman you are. Anyway, okay. Thank you very much, Rachel.
Thank
that's brilliant.
You, Nick.
Thank you.
Was she brilliant?
She was. That was really lovely. Yeah, really, really lovely. And yeah, proper thought.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. So thank you, Rachel. My fourth choice. I was gonna go for a little Marty Buber and I and Thou, but it's very dense and it's very odd. It's a really odd book. It's a really strange book. So I'm gonna change because I've suddenly thought I missed out my absolute favourite Christian book, which is Unapologetic by Francis Spufford.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a sort of defence of the faith, but in really exciting terms. And he when I read this book, Unapologetic, he doesn't write about Christianity in the way that I'd ever experienced anybody else writing. It literally changed the way that I wrote. Mm. That's what happens when you, I thought I can learn from this guy. This is amazing. And he just puts everything in such context. He talks a lot about mercy. He talks a lot about... It's all about why Christianity makes surprising emotional sense. Mm. And I think I've talked about it before in the sense that he doesn't... He reframes sin as the human propensity to things up.
Mm.
And suddenly you think, yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. It's not me being totally depraved or deliberately evil. It's just that things go wrong. And to have someone in your life, to have a presence in your life that accepts all of that and can transform all of that is wonderful. And he's wonderfully witty. He's very funny in terms of writing about some of the sort of new atheism and all that kind of stuff. Great. Unapologetic by Francis Spofford. I thoroughly recommend that.
Yes, indeed. I'm glad you picked another book that I know and have read. That's good.
Yeah, good. Okay.
Okay. Well, my final choice is a new book, which I read, but it just absolutely warmed my heart so much. I think because I can relate so well to this journey. This is written by an American guy called Kent Dobson, who's like a Pharisee of Pharisees. He's a bit St. Paul-like in that his grandfather was a kind of big evangelical preacher. Then his father before him was a great evangelical preacher. And now Kent, sure enough, was following in that path. And then he just describes the enormous unravelling of questions and doubts and doctrine. He ends up spending quite a lot of time in the Holy Land. And he goes on a pilgrimage, takes himself on a pilgrimage up Sinai. He wants to go up Sinai to this holy place where people have met with God. And he wants to know, you know, is God going to meet with him? And, you know, this is all in the beginning of the book, so it's not really a spoiler. He comes back down. He's attacked by a camel. He is literally bitten by a camel. And he sort of thinks, well, I'm sure this is a metaphor for something very important, but it kind of isn't. And he's so low. And then he just takes you on this journey of his questioning. And like how serious that is when you're a minister, because you lose your job, basically. Don't understand why I relate to this at all. And so you know, he just gives that I know we've talked about this a lot, but that doctrine of original sin, such a big treatment that it's absolutely, because if you go with that, which of course is not strictly speaking orthodoxy, half the church, the Eastern Orthodox Church, never accepted it.
No, that's right.
You know, so he explains how, you know, when you have that, when the whole problem with the world is you're a problem to God, then you have to come up with these atonement theories where God comes to fix you that are a problem to God. And that's why we have these hideous, you know, theories of the atonement bouncing around. And so he takes you on the questions, and it's another one of these people who dares to voice the doubts we have. So he tells one encounter when he's in a restaurant, and a bomber comes into a restaurant, and he's rejected, turned away from the pizza. He goes down a bit further, and he detonates the bomb there, kills people. It's very close to where Kent actually was, and, you know. And just how some people said, oh, how wonderful that God spared you and spared the people in the first restaurant. Well, what about the people in the second restaurant? Yeah, and what about, do they matter less to God? And so he really takes on that kind of, you know, that simple but very difficult belief. Oh, God's behind all the actions that are going on in the world, and God's in control and everything, and leads you to a new, possibly new ways of thinking about what it means that God's in control, or God is not in control, in fact. And what that might mean for our faith. And I just found it enormously heartwarming that here's a guy who is not only articulating the really deep questions of doubt and faith, but actually not leaving you there, but bringing you through and helping open you up to new ways of thinking about the divine presence in the world and how this could work and what this could mean for our faith and how we can genuinely trust in a God who is present, but not using the old terms that we perhaps are used to. Loved
Great.
It. Absolutely loved it. So that's Bitten by a Camel by Kent Dobson.
Kent Dobson. Great.
Yeah.
My fifth choice, I couldn't really come down on anything because as I've started doing this podcast, it's been really interesting. I've realised that so much of what we talked about was first talked about by... or it was contained in the works of George MacDonald, who I've quoted a lot, I know. And the reason I quote a lot is because he keeps cropping up in my mind. So George MacDonald is a Scottish congregational minister, brought up in, you know, in a sort of Scottish Protestantism and all that entailed. And he, in the mid-19th century, he was a huge influence on C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and Chesterton and people like that.
Right, okay.
And I've just become aware of how much of his work actually is anticipating all of this stuff. He was, you're like this, he was a congregational minister. He was a minister in Arundel, which is not far from you. And he was sacked from the Arundel church for... saying that basically for there's a lot of wealthy people, and he once preached a sermon that said you can see what God thinks of riches when you see the kind of people he gives it to. How little he thinks of riches.
Brilliant.
And he got chucked out of his church, and he became a writer, and he wrote amazing fantasy books in really sort of almost kickstarted that genre. Amazing fairy tales. All the time they're infused by this understanding of God. And as I said in I think the last podcast, he talks about God. His God figures are female often, the grandmother figure. He talks about finding your true self, becoming who you should be. He talks a lot about the shadow in one of his books in Fantasties. Wow. There's this character of the shadow that you
have to get
rid of.
When was he writing?
Fantasties was 1857.
Wow.
So he's writing it in the latter half of the
19th century. Incredibly contemporary, yeah.
So I suggest you get hold of an anthology of George MacDonald. There's the one done by C.S. Lewis called George MacDonald, an anthology, which is widely available. There's another one that I quite like called...
Hang on, you're having two books here.
I know, but they're both George MacDonald. The Gospel and George MacDonald. Which is selections from his writing. But really, you could find lots of George MacDonald online. I'm not going to kind of suggest something. But an anthology of George MacDonald, I think, would be great. He was also one, he really, and this brings us back to Gareth's email. He talked a lot about death, good death, and about, he was a universalist. That was another reason why he was unpopular. He believed everybody...
I like him more and more.
And
he was thrown out of a church in West Sussex.
Yeah, I know. He's unlike you in that he had a lot of hair and a big beard.
And he was incredibly intelligent. creative.
But there's a line in a really weird but compelling little story called The Golden Key, which is a sort of fairy tale, when it has these two characters who go on journeys. And he and one of the characters who they meet is called the old man. And the old man says to a character called Mossy, he says, "You have tasted of death now," said the old man. "Is it good?" "It's good," said Mossy. "It's better than life." "No," said the old man. "It's only more life." You know, he was just really a prophet. So anything by George MacDonald. Okay. There we go.
So this feels like we've been quite indulgent.
Yes,
but what would be really great, and what this is where this is all leading, listeners. You can see it coming, can't you? That we'd love to hear from you. If you could send us an email, what's the books that's really helped you on your journey? What do you love and why? So if you can try and give us the book title, the author, and then just maybe two sentences on why it's such a great book, we'll read it out and we'll share the love around.
Yeah, I'd love to hear that.
That's helpful. That would be really great. So it only remains to be said, we look forward to getting your emails and have a wonderful trip to the States.
Thank you very much.
Give my regards to John Roberts and co.
I hope to be allowed in. That would be the first thing.
I hope you're allowed out.
first barrier to cross. Yeah, we'll be with you in 2 weeks' time. Thanks ever so much for listening. I'm going back to bed.
Great. See you now. Bye, folks. Bye.